Welcome to Shorts Season 3. I'm Jen Thomas. I live in London, UK.
And I'm Lindsay Falconer, and I live in Portland, Oregon.
We are two long-distance friends who want to talk about what we're reading.
This podcast is about how reading short stories can show the world through different perspectives. Today we're reading The Heart in the House by Aaron Muller. It was published in Cold Signal Literary Magazine, Volume 1 in the Fall 2022 edition. We've linked the story in the show notes.
Aaron Muller lives in Poughkeepsie, New York with his husband and their two cats. He's a graduate of the State University of New York Creative Writing Program. He's published several essays and short stories since 2019.
The Heart in the House is a surrealist dive into a woman's relationship with her home. Part comedy, part horror, we follow Ginny as she discovers the house she recently purchased appears to be alive. The countertops sigh, the kitchen sink yelps, and Ginny tries to negotiate her life and human relationships as she becomes increasingly entangled with her home. Okay, Jen, what did you think?
What happens? What is this story? I mean, I love this story, but I am not 100% sure I would know how to describe it.
Yeah, when I was trying to classify it, I was like, it is a little bit fantasy, but it feels really surreal. It's anchored in parts of reality, and then absolutely twists and turns in different directions. And as someone who's been trying to buy a home, and almost bought a home, and then the inspection came back very, very scary with lots of issues, I really felt this one in my bones.
Yeah, it's a very strange story. It's a very strange kind of, I don't know, moment, days, weeks. I don't know how long we're with this character. I don't know where we are.
Yeah.
It's like we know so little. We've got so few anchor points. But I mean, I was swept along and I was really intrigued as to what was going on and the relationship sort of between Ginny, this main character, and the house that she's in sort of twists and turns and grows, and the character of the house kind of becomes more and more alive as you go through the story. And I was just spent the whole time going, what the hell? And what just happened? And what's happening now? Like, it's very, very intriguing. And I love that. I love that.
It's very funny. It's very fast moving. And then it ends.
It's very funny.
Yeah, it's very funny. I mean, yeah. We'll start at the beginning. It was early in the morning when Ginny discovered that her house was alive. Early enough she could convince herself she was probably still asleep. But when she poured herself another cup of coffee and the countertop sighed when she put down her mug, she knew she had to reevaluate the situation.
It's so good. Like that second cup of coffee and she was like, oh no, I'm definitely awake now. Like the second, just the clarity that comes with your second cup. Love that.
Yeah. And so she's in this new house. She's just purchased it. And what happens is she starts noticing that anytime she's interacting with the house, so putting the coffee cup down on the counter, turning on the sink, dusting, anything, the house is giving her like an auditory reaction, which would make me feel truly insane.
Yeah. And for a chunk of this story, I was thinking, we're understanding, that she, as this lead character, is somehow having visions, or she's having kind of hallucinations, auditory hallucinations. Is that what we'd say? Like, mm-hmm. you're just assuming that there's something maybe about her. But really early on, the author is like, no, I'm going to introduce a second character. He's going to hear the same sounds. So we only get like a couple of paragraphs at the beginning where I was like, okay, I'm really intrigued as to how this woman's kind of, hallucinations are going to develop. And then suddenly we get Howie round. And Howie comes over. He seems very sweet. He comes over with a housewarming gift. He's brought mimosas. And he's in it and he hears it and he just completely blows that out of the water. And we realize that this is actually something that is is happening.
Yeah, Howie's a great addition, bringing him into the fold of this house. And I was surprised that neither of them were like, maybe it's a ghost. I don't know what this says about me, but 100% I would have been like, this place is haunted. Like, get out the sage, call somebody in. Like, this place is haunted. But no, she knows. She feels it. She's like, this house is alive. And she starts interacting with it. Even after the first, she's like apologizing to the house. It seems to hurt the house when she does things too.
Yeah.
Sometimes it hurts the house. It's complicated.
It definitely feels like that. I mean, obviously, we learn that that does happen kind of later when she starts the renovations. We know that that's what's happening. But yeah, there's a kind of interactivity with the house. The house really obviously is this kind of, you know, additional character in the story. But I just love that as she sort of starts to realize and starts to kind of interact with it, we learn a little bit more about her as well, and about who she is as a person. And there's this sort of playful side for sure. But, you know, the author also tells us that, you know, she's just gone through a breakup. She's changed her career. She's obviously just moved. Like, she's done the trifecta. Like, she's done the trifecta where you kind of all of those three sort of facets of your life change at the same time. And it's a crazy, I don't know if you've ever gone through the trifecta.
I have. It's my specialty. I've gone through it a few times.
And I just love that she kind of goes through this and then she goes, oh, maybe this is the start of a meltdown. And the author even reflects that if it was 70 years or so ago, she might be treated for hysteria. I mean, we just get this sense that there's, you know, that she was maybe kind of questioning where she's at. But as you say, like, they didn't even think about, you know, once Howie's there and endorses her and says, yeah, this is happening, then they're like, yeah, this house is alive. There's no ghost. There's no conversation of like, are we mad? Like, what was in the mimosas? You know, there's no question of that. It's like, okay, the house is alive. We've established that as fact.
Yeah.
And we're at like paragraph four.
Yeah. I guess my whole thing is like, wouldn't you call someone? But then I'm like, who would you call? The priest?
Who would you call?
An exorcist? Yeah. Like, you know, and she doesn't. She's not interested really in asking for help. She's glad Howie believes her, but she's kind of entranced with the house. I love the descriptions of how the house sounds. They're so particular and specific, and it's so good. You know, she says, the author writes, every click of the stove as she waited for the flame to light sounded like an impatient cough, someone clearing their throat before singing warmly, the heat set to medium.
Yeah, it's beautifully written. I mean, there's some of the passages of this, is the descriptions and the language that Muller uses throughout of describing the house is so poetic, and it's so human. It's so humanized, you know, we're really understanding that this is kind of a beautiful character, a beautiful person kind of coming to life all around us.
Mm-hmm. And Ginny's starting to interact with it and build a bond with the house. She decides that she's going to start taking notes on the house's reactions to things, where she hears it, how she hears it.
I love this. I love the inventory that she writes. It's so funny.
It's so funny.
It's so funny. And we've gone from this quite poetic description of the author, and then the kind of, you know, the story changes into this kind of list. And the list is obviously Ginny's voice, because she's like kind of noting down this inventory. And suddenly we get a little bit of who Ginny is, and this kind of sense of humor and kind of blunt language that's totally different from what we've just heard, the passage you were just describing. You know, bedroom, pre-furnished lamp gasps like you're fucking it when you switch it on. Closet doors murmur shyly about something. It's just, it's just wonderful. And the kind of the description is just as strong, but it's very funny. It's very funny and kind of curt.
It's so good. Bathroom, sink yells. Bathtub sounds kind of horny. Showerhead also horny. How am I supposed to bathe? I love it. The stark contrast, like you're saying, between these kind of bullet punctual, funny comedic bits with the rest of what we've read so far, which are these elongated descriptions of this woman walking in through her apartment and experiencing it is funny. It keeps it interesting. It moves the story forward. I love it.
I love it. And I love it when a writer is able to tell us something about the character without telling us anything about the character. Like, we don't have a lot of descriptions of Ginny in this story. We're not sort of told really very much about her.
But what she looks like, we don't get much at all. Who her family is. We know she's gone through a breakup, but we don't know her.
No, we don't really know her. But the writer so cleverly gives us sort of insights into her and who she is through, you know, descriptions like the list you've just read. I start to really like who she is.
Mm-hmm. I just have to call out this one point in her list. She says, guest bedroom, carpet says it's lonely. I'm obsessed with it. I don't know why. I love it. It's so unexpected. What? Like, one, the house is speaking in full words now. It's not just making sounds.
That's the first thing. Yeah, that's the first time we've heard that, for sure. Guest bedroom.
Carpet no says guests. It's lonely.
No guests coming through this house.
Oh, so good. So smart.
So good. Yeah. Yeah. Incredible. I think that this starts to chug along, basically. Once they've established this about the house, we then suddenly, we're kind of all over the place. We learn that she's traveling for work, Howie comes round, they talk about the house renovation that she wants to do. We meet this, you know, all of this happens in quite quick succession. We meet this contractor, and then we're kind of at like, you know, we're almost like, here's chapter two, because things shift when we meet Joseph, the contractor.
Yeah. And the house renovation really is Chekhov's gun in this story. There it is. That's my literary reference for today.
Very good. Would you like to explain Chekhov's gun for our listeners?
Yeah, I'm sure I'll explain it badly. I think Anton Chekhov wrote that you can't introduce a gun in the first half of the play for it not to go off in the second half of the play. Like, it exists for a reason.
Yeah.
Especially in short stories, when you don't have much time or space on the page, everything that is introduced to you as the reader or, you know, someone watching a play is important. So that's the terrible version. I apologize to those of you who are smarter than me and better read and are like, that's not quite it. But that's the general idea.
That's the gist. Yeah, that's the gist. That's the kind of, it's hanging over us for the rest of the story, this renovation.
Yeah, foreboding. Like, ooh, this house is alive and she wants to renovate it? Uh-oh.
Yeah. And even in the conversation with Howie, we're like, oh, like Howie's like, you should renovate this house. I mean, he tells, Howie is like an all-knowing figure in this story. So yeah, he calls it.
Yeah, yeah. So then we have our fourth character, if you count the house, which is the contractor. Here he comes to evaluate the house and to have a sudden romantic entanglement with our girl, Ginny. This is like a dream come true or a nightmare.
This is, I mean, there are a lot of erotic films, I'd imagine, that follow this. Like, handsome contractor arrives in baseball cap, removes baseball cap, and they have sex. My main overriding takeout from this interaction is that, I don't know, shower sex on number one time, having sex with someone.
Bold.
I feel like that's pretty out there.
Bold. Pretty bold.
That is bold.
Yeah,
I mean, also, they haven't even been in the shower.
And it's a horny shower.
There's a lot to think about. The horny shower didn't make any sound when they were having...
Grosser.
When they were having sex.
Weirder.
Yeah.
I don't know. Blech. It's all starting to get weirder quickly.
Yeah.
And also, Joseph, the contractor, gives us some important pieces of information about the house right off the bat. You know, she asks him, do you know who lived in this house before me? And he says, no, it's been on the market since it was built. They didn't tell you anything about it. And then we find out that she was in a hurry to buy a house.
Because of the trifecta.
Because of the trifecta.
Because she wanted to move change jobs and ditch her boyfriend. So
made a rash decision.
Yeah, she in a hurry to buy, and she made a rash decision and didn't notice that the house was alive.
You know, we've all the inspector really should have told her this. I feel like it should have been in the report.
That building survey, it definitely could have told her that.
Maybe she waived the inspection. Maybe this is COVID times.
Maybe. This story was just published in 2022, so. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, I think, as well, like, as the relationship with Joseph develops, there's this line which I loved, where she says that he came back a few times without all of his tools, but with wine and fancy cheese instead, and Ginny began to consider loving him.
It's so good.
It's so good. That writing is so great. Like, just the idea that she was like, okay, you brought wine and fancy cheese. Firstly, obviously, tick, tick, tick for Ginny. Potentially also for myself. But just that sort of distance, that sort of step back when, you know, began to consider loving him. It's the same way that she, when she first sees him and she isn't sure if she's going to sort of, like, if she fancies him or not, she says she studied him for a minute to figure out whether or not she was free. A few hours later, they had sex. Like, she sort of just takes a minute, evaluates the situation. Am I going to have sex with him? Am I going to fall in love with him? And I kind of like that. Again, this little clue about who Ginny is just dropped in with that simple, simple line.
Yeah, she keeps her guard up. She's got her walls up. She views everything, you know, through this lens of almost logic. It's like, could I consider loving him? She definitely is a step back from some of the relationships in her life, which is interesting as she gets more and more intertwined with the house and the house's feelings. Because Joseph is very different from Howie. Howie's like, don't renovate the kitchen. And Joseph is like, you know, it's no big deal. I'll give you a little bit of a discount. The orange in this kitchen is very ugly. Let's do it.
I mean, it's interesting because it's like he also, I mean, they're sleeping together, but he's also like, I'm going to renovate the house. You know, like, whereas Howie's like, you know, kind of more, approaches that more sensitively.
That's true. You know, Joseph does have a financial incentive here in renovating this house, but I would be terrified. Like, aren't they terrified? The house is, I don't know, I think this is already when the house is speaking full sentences to her.
Yeah.
And they're kind of trying to figure it out together, but they're not getting very far. They can't. They're looking, they're dusting, they're looking around, but they're not able to really get it, understand what's happening.
Yeah. You know, they even have this moment where they talk about the morality of the house. I mean, they talk about it really explicitly, of the morality of the renovation with Howie and his boyfriend, Rich. And then Rich goes on and starts talking about Tamagotchis. I mean, did you have a Tamagotchi, Lizzie? I was like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
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 Okay.
Yeah. Did you?
I didn't. I saw this phenomena. I think often what happened when these things kind of like raced through the schoolyard is I thought they were kind of stupid. And then by the time I had kind of realized that actually they were kind of cool and I wanted to get involved, the time had passed. I felt the same way about Take That.
I don't know what Take That is.
Oh, no. Okay. Take That is a very successful boy band in the UK.
Like S Club 7?
How have you heard of S Club 7? You haven't heard of Take That. This is wild.
They had a reality show in the US. S Club. Oh, God. Yes, I've learned not to sing.
It was set in like Miami or something.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved it.
Hold on. I can't believe that S Club 7 made it over in the States and Take That didn't. Take That were a much more successful band.
Oh, okay.
Take That were like the first boy band of its kind, like a kind of manufactured boy band. And after them came everybody else, basically. They were the trailblazers.
They were the trailblazers from which One Direction would follow.
Yeah, like literally. I mean, One Direction standing on the shoulders of giants.
Okay, I will be Googling. Take that after this. But
I mean, I'm going to send you some of their top tracks. I'm also...
Please do.
I'm already formulating the Instagram stories that we will...
I can't wait.
That we'll be doing. When people are like, there is no connection between this story and Take That, and, you know...
That doesn't matter. Maybe it does.
It's fine. Maybe.
Yeah, it's fine. I definitely had, I mean, just to go back to Tamagotchis and these little things that we think are alive. I mean, I was a weird kid who like loved animals. And so any chance I got to pretend that I was taking care of an animal, like Tamagotchis or Nano Pets online, where you would like, it was like a little game where you got these little kind of cute figures and then you'd feed it. And I don't really remember anything else, but wow. I was all
I've
about
not heard
it.
Of Nano Pets.
I was all, yeah, I barely remember, but I do remember it was like caretaking animals, a great passion of mine since I was a child. Yeah. So this would be hard for me, this house, because also, is it moral for them to do this to the house? I just feel like these would not be my questions. I understand that Ginny is tougher and funnier than I am. So she's a different agenda. But I would be like, how do I sell this house as fast as possible? And she's like, how do I make this kitchen more usable?
Yeah, and she gets to the point where she's like, I just can't stand the kitchen. And it's like, okay, it's orange tiles, but it's not like, it's a new house.
You can't stand the kitchen. The sink is screaming at you.
Yeah.
But this, our girl can compartmentalize.
That's a very good point.
She's got a hot contractor, boyfriend, guy, you know.
Considered this.
She just wants him around to have like, a cute time. And I think she doesn't realize how involved she is with the house. I don't think she realizes that she also is like pretty attached emotionally to her creepy, creepy home.
Yeah, I think she is attached. And I think that the decision that she makes, it's kind of strange that she makes a decision seemingly kind of quite lightly, like Rich, her and Howie, they talk about kind of just blast out some music and she's like, okay. But then she sort of has to like close herself up in her office. Like she knows that she would kind of cry if she sees someone else crying, and she knows that she's going to be really distressed by what happens to the house. It's kind of an odd decision that she feels like she does want to renovate the kitchen, but she does hate those orange tiles.
I feel like Ginny has a problem that I've had before, which is I ignore my feelings and push forward with action because it feels like that's the right thing to do, is to move forward, renovate the kitchen. Who gives a shit? While inside, she's like very uncomfortable with it, but she's just ignoring that and she's moving forward. And she's moving forward by putting on a Teenage Mix CD and blasting it loudly with a lot of Kate Bush, where we see a red flag with Joseph where he makes fun of the Kate Bush on
super
her CD.
I mean, that would be an immediate.
I mean,
immediate.
Out the door, my guy.
Yeah.
How dare? Yeah. How dare he talk about her?
That is a mistake that he makes.
Yeah.
Kate Bush forever.
Yeah.
In our hearts. But I mean, she does. I mean, to be fair, and this is where I feel like I'm just identifying so hard with the writer, because the writer also was like unacceptable. So she briefly considered dumping him for besmirching Kate Bush, but then he smiled and the house sighed. And you know, but I just like that she did kind of go, wait, hold on. Maybe he has crossed a line.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting that this section with Kate Bush and the Teenage Mix, I've recently been thinking, what is this story a metaphor for? Like, what is this house a metaphor for? There must, like, what is the deeper meaning? And I think it is interesting that you're saying, like, you know, she's been trying to take action rather than dealing with her feelings. And she kind of pushes those emotions down when she's in the office and something is kind of hurtful that's happening to the house. You know, she tries to kind of ignore it and drown it out. And she's drowning it out with her kind of like teenage music. we know that she's had a big breakup. We know that she's like changed jobs. Like she's gone through quite big things, and she is kind of constantly moving forward. There's something there that I think is really interesting, but I can't, you know, is the house kind of an expression, like a bigger expression of her? Like we heard about the shower being horny and that's the first place she has sex. Like what's happening? Like this was a point in the story where I was like, why can't I quite grasp this?
I don't know. I think that that's as good as any.
Like, tell me, Lizzie.
I don't know. But at this point in the story, I can tell you, I was like anxious. I was like, I don't like it. I don't like where this is going. Like the tension is ratcheted up. I don't know what the house is a metaphor for.
If it is,
but so she's blasting the music. Joseph is in the kitchen. He's starting this renovation. She's hiding away, and it says, and she heard the first little whimper that always came before a great big sob. And, ah, shit, she said, pushing out her chair. It was then that the walls began to wail. She covered her ears. They shrieked like an infant keeping up its parents in the middle of the night. Endless, ear-splitting cries.
Yikes. I mean, I am not a parent of an infant, but I have heard some ear-splitting cries coming from my nieces and nephews. And just the idea that she is in her house and that sound is around her and coming out of... Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible. And we have this moment. She has this moment of clarity of it reminded her that she too was capable of crying. It made her remember times that she had cried and how she'd felt while crying. And this is suddenly that distance between her and her emotions, her and other people is getting smaller, is smacking into her. And she runs out of her room yelling for Joseph. And then we find out that the house is not just making noises. The house seems to have some kind of autonomous power, which maybe we should have guessed with the turning of the knob that it can make things happen. But she comes into the kitchen and Joseph has his head in the oven and she can hear the clicking of the oven, the gas.
Oh my God.
Yikes.
I mean, the abandoned drill spinning aimlessly and unattached. I was like, something's going to happen.
I know.
Anxiety peaked. But yeah, I mean, Joseph has his head by the gas oven and oh, it's just awful. And so we realize that the house has kind of manipulated him into this. He's trying to basically, the house is basically trying to kill Joseph. And she manages to pull him away. Obviously, the gas stops and he's okay. And what I find amazing is that she pulls Joseph away. She yells, I'm sorry. But you realize she's yelling, I'm sorry to the house.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I'm sorry, we'll stop. She's not saying I'm sorry to Joseph.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's so upset that they've actually hurt the house. And she's like overwhelmed. This man is dying in front of her. The house has just let out these tremendous wails. Like, this is, shit is wild. Shit is wild.
Yeah. And I love this line. The sobbing stopped. The clicking of the stove stopped. Kate Bush kept singing. Oh, I just feel like we just got Wuthering Heights, like blaring out. And she's, you know, oh, they're just in a heap on the floor. It's so dark. It's so good.
It's so dark. And then Ginny does something unexpected that I think sets us up for the final part of the story, is that even though Joseph was nearly killed by her insane house, she tells him she wants to be alone with the house for a while. She's isolating. She wants to heal the relationship with the house. That's more important to her. And why? Why is the house? She's intrigued by it. She doesn't want to hurt it, but like she's starting to lose it to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And she wanders, once she's alone in the house, she wanders around. She's sort of stroking the walls. She's wandering up and down, like hearing the walls sighing. And then there's this moment where it says she spread out her arms, sliding her palms along the wall, turning her head until her cheek was pressed against it. She stepped as close as she could, her belly touching the wall. She could feel her heartbeat through it, echoing between the wall and her body. She wondered if the house had a heart somewhere, maybe in the water heater. Now she knew she couldn't take it apart to look. She is, like, holding her arms outstretched and pressing her belly and her face and her cheek, like, against the wall. Like, she's hugging the house. She's kind of connecting with the house on this physical level. And it's bizarre. It's quite extraordinary.
It's the most emotional and open and empathetic we see her throughout the entire story. And that is contrasted with that image, like you're saying, that image of her pressed up against the wall. That's so absurd. I mean, earlier she's thinking this place was designed to be broken, an ugly kitchen, an unfinished basement. Mm-hmm. Someone had built a thing that they knew would be torn apart, something that was created just to suffer. Ginny didn't bother with the how of the situation. That's really something created just to suffer.
Yeah.
She's in it. She's involved. She's staying with this house.
And it's just after this section that we see a direct replacement of Joseph, like, by the house. So she's still sort of embracing the wall somehow. It says, she tapped her knuckles against it, searching for studs, for seams. The house didn't cry when she felt its bones. It seemed to breathe, to exhale at her touch, like peaceful snoring, like her head on Joseph's chest at night. She could live with an ugly, undone kitchen, she supposed. I mean,
oh my.
They have this, like, they suddenly have a physical relationship of sorts. And she's comparing, obviously, the house directly with her boyfriend.
She's become so far away from actual humans that she's in a romantic relationship with her demonic house.
Yeah. And it's really like an abuser, like it becomes this kind of abuser abused relationship, because, you know, we then, and again, this is another point where the story, the pace of the story just tips up. We have this kind of moment where we pause, where she's embracing the house, where she's got this alone time and everything's very still and sort of dreamlike and breath-like and you know, she's sort of at one with the house. And then we then hurtle into like plot, plot, plot. Everything's sort of happening again. And the writer says it was growing bolder, talking about the house. It was speaking in full sentences like a growing child, which was something she never wanted. Thinking they were building a rapport, she had begun to bring things into the attic. And it's like, building a rapport with the house? What the... It's amazing. And she asks it, what hurts? She asks the house, what hurts? So it's like, part of it's like a relationship with her boyfriend. Part of it's like a relationship with a child.
I mean, who hurt you, Ginny?
Yeah.
Who hurt you? Talk about she's asking the house what hurts and the house can't explain it beyond its body, beyond hurt. Ginny has not talked about her own life. She's not engaged at all beyond with the house's feelings. This she's developing codependency with the house.
Yeah.
This is where you need friends. You know, you need friends to break down the doors and be like,
well,
you need a break.
Howie and Rich come round, but they aren't like, they aren't really engaging. I mean, I think they're like, we don't want to come and hang out with Ginny anymore because she's, you know, she's kind of gone a bit mad here.
Yeah. And then we get that moment that where
it's amazing. This moment,
it's so good. You know, Howie's asking her like, what is keeping you here? They're alone in the kitchen. You know, are you going to move? He's seeing the absurdity of the situation. And she says, nothing's not keeping me here. She told him, sure, she'd broken up with Joseph and hadn't been to work in weeks, but that was no reason to uproot herself again. She thought about how well that had gone the last time she'd done it and could feel the angry carpet prickle against her bare feet. You can always stay with me, he assured her. The house turned the doorknob. It was time for him to leave. It's like enveloping her, the angry carpet against her feet. It's forcing things to happen. It wants Howie, who's telling her she needs to leave the house. The house wants Howie gone. The house wants Ginny for itself.
Yeah, that alone wants Ginny kind of isolated and alone with the house. Oof, it's hard. It's like it gives you chills.
It's so creepy. It's so creepy. And it's all the language. I love the, I keep saying contrast in this story. I do know other words, but between the comedy and the characters, and then the kind of horror that's building of this house. Yeah. And we come to the climax of all of this, what it's been building towards at the very end.
This final section, it begins with something that really hit me. And I was suddenly like, how have I never thought about this before? She's describing the house. She found that its most tender parts were ceilings. She thought about how the ceiling is the part of a room that no one touches unless they're batting away the cobwebs. And that is why the house cooed so lovingly when she brushed the feather duster around its corners. Again, this is where I just want to sort of dig and dig and dig, because it's like, what is that part of her that no one touches? Like, what is that connection that's being made between her and the house? Because in this section, we also understand that, like, she starts to almost kind of become one with the house. And we're going to talk about that language in a second. But just that idea that its most tender parts are the ceilings, because it's where nobody touches.
Yeah, what is it that she needs that she's giving to the house but not getting?
Like, what are the most tender parts of her that nobody is touching, that nobody can get close to? Mm-hmm. Like, what, you know, how is that playing out? And I think what's kind of brilliant is that we don't know. The author doesn't tell us. But that just raised for me so many kind of more questions about Ginny and about her experience.
Yeah, she's just thought to herself when Howie was asking her about the house, why, you know, she knows how well it had gone for her last time, the breakup and the move. Like, things have happened to her that she's not talking about. She's not even sharing to herself in her interior thoughts. She's just thinking, oh, that went badly, but we're not getting the details. She won't even touch it in her own thoughts, but she can project it onto this terrifying, murderous house.
Yeah. Yeah. And then this is where we get this kind of big ending, which I really want to discuss.
I know.
I'm excited that we've reached it, because
we haven't talked about it either yet.
I don't know if I understand it, but I'm excited to discuss it. So she sets up a big wooden ladder in the living room so that she can dust the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And then just like she did with the wall, she kind of, when she gets up to the top of the ladder, she almost kind of embraces the ceiling. She stretches out her arms. She wants to sort of twist her feet around so that she could get her face really close to the ceiling as well and touch it. And as she starts to do that, this is where we get this incredible section where she sort of seems to become like one with the house somehow. It says, she strained her eyes to look at one of her outstretched hands and found that her skin was paler than usual. Maybe being in this position had taken all the blood from her fingertips, and she really ought to get down and start dinner if that was all right. She wiggled her fingers and watched as the movement shook some dusty plaster from the ceiling. Her skin was so eggshell white and smooth. She tried to move her elbow and her joints felt dry, like something painted but not gloss. Her skin was the color of a base coat. Something plastery was stuck to her hair. And she felt the rhythmic pulsing of the spinning ceiling fan in her chest and in her belly. So it's like her skin becomes like like egg white, and the plaster dust kind of is on her. The beat of the ceiling fan is her, like her heartbeat. Like, she's sort of morphing into being part, or being kind of assimilated into the ceiling. What did you think was happening here, Lizzie? What is going on?
I'm like, oh, the house is like taking her in, is what I thought of it. Yeah. It was like bringing her back into, I almost felt like it was like bringing her into the world of the house, this kind of separate dimension. Because it says the house had a heart, four chambered, like a number of bedrooms. After a while, so then we're snapped back into kind of the human realm, Ginny's neck stopped hurting and she found that she could relax her stance on the ladder without slipping off. Nothing really hurt anymore at all until it got very hot beneath her feet.
So that section you just read, the house had a heart, four chambered, like a number of bedrooms. Does that mean that like she, this process of her kind of a, sort of like going into the ceiling, that is that talking about her heart? Like she is now the heart in the house? The title of the story?
Probably.
Like, is that what's happening?
Yeah, I think she's becoming the heart of the house. I kind of was like, is she seeing into this other dimension and seeing this big heart the size of four bedrooms? But I think what you're saying checks out, that she's becoming the human part of the house. Maybe the house has eaten people before. Maybe that's how the house stays alive, is that it sucks people in and they become the house. You know, they're taking out her soul and putting, she's becoming the house.
I mean, I thought that, but then there's that line earlier where it talks about how it had never been occupied before, the house after it was built. So it's like, I almost was like, ah, that doesn't quite, maybe it hasn't taken on anyone else, but maybe it was kind of, maybe it needed a heart and that is her.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it needed a heart and that was her. It's, I don't like this house, I can tell you that.
Not one for your house hunting that you're doing.
No, hard pass on this one.
Yeah, hard pass on this. And you're going to be listening out for sighs and yells and swearing in the basement.
Oh, my God. And so in the middle of this scene, which is already like wild, you know, she's getting she's becoming the ceiling. We get this until it got very hot beneath her feet. She could hear the low whipping of flames as they climbed the old wood, could hear it spreading from the epicenter, from the oily match that had been tossed through the window by a jilted lover. Is Joseph burning down the house?
So this is where I was like, wait, what? I assumed that the house, that the story was ending with her like assimilating into the house. But somebody, there is an oily match, right? By a jilted lover. I mean, we know that she's had two jilted lovers in this story, right? Mm-hmm. You've got Joseph, we've got her ex-boyfriend who never has a name. We also have the house itself somehow, I guess, which is like somehow she's had a kind of loving love relationship there. I don't know. I would guess that it was Joseph because he's kind of the jilted lover, but it seems super extreme for Joseph. I mean, it seems super extreme.
Yeah. I mean, he calls her, he says earlier, like you're acting like a real fucking bitch, Ginny, or something. But that is a pretty big escalation to burning the house down.
Also, she was acting kind of mad. Like, he was the victim of some kind of attempted murder, and she was like, cool, but let's look after the house.
Yeah, I mean, I understand why he would want to burn that house down. It tried to kill him.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that kind of makes more sense, but it's like, he knows that she was probably in there. It's not like we heard the sound of a telephone ringing off the, you know, like, he didn't check if she wasn't in there, so.
Maybe he thought she'd be able to get out, but because she's synthesized with the ceiling, she just stands there. She can't scream. Like, she's, I feel like maybe it is two different things. Like, the house is finally eating her alive, is taking her in. At the same time that Joseph decides to throw a match into this house and burn it down for good. And because the house has trapped her, like it trapped Joseph earlier, she can't escape.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because it says she had accepted that there was no self to free. Like, she couldn't get free because she's completely lost herself. There's nothing there. God. And, you know, it says when she died, there was nothing left. It was like, when that's not necessarily because it's her body's been consumed by the flame so much as she's already lost herself to the house.
Yeah. And it ends, a plastery ceiling woman, she couldn't make any tears to turn into steam in the heat. And we know she can't cry. She earlier was thinking about all the times she couldn't cry. I mean, she's just completely lost herself, her inability to connect emotionally with real people, to face what's actually happening has put her in a situation where she can't run from danger. She can't. She's immersed in the house. She's not separate from this anymore.
Exactly. And I think that that's where, you know, the house being alive almost feels like it almost feels like it could be irrelevant in terms of her journey, in terms of what we know about what she's kind of just gone through and the sort of hints of kind of trauma that we get from the experiences of her crying and that sort of, or not being able to cry and kind of the trauma that that brings up and some of the imagery that's used, that she uses about, you know, an infant screaming for her parents and that sort of thing. And you just think actually, you know, has she just been taken so far out, like so far kind of deeply away? She's had to kind of push other people in her life away. She's gone into this house. She's no longer kind of connecting with other people. She's pushing away all of her emotions and she's kind of just she's lost in this house. And does it matter that the house was alive? Is that relevant to her experience? I don't know.
It's, you know, we end the story and we don't really know more about Ginny or about Ginny's past. We know more about Ginny's internal life. We don't know more about Ginny's past. We don't know why this house is alive. We don't know what happened to it. And that I a little bit love that infuriating end where you're like, what just happened? You feel like you were on a roller coaster ride. You're like, what? But it's fun and it's interesting. And it's, I love that about this story, that I'm thinking about it and trying to understand it and capturing different ideas of what it could mean even after we've finished it. He's not giving us all the answers. The author isn't wrapping this up tightly in a nice bow, but it was fun. Thanks for reading with me, Jen.
Thanks for reading with me, Lizzie.